Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest this afternoon is Ralph Hall, professor of practice at the University of Minnesota Law School. Professor Hall is counsel to the Indianapolis, Indiana firm of Baker & Daniels, where he counsels clients in the area of drug and medical device regulation. He also serves as CEO of MR3 Medical, a startup medical device company. Ralph, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Watching the saga of the user fee agreements being renewed between the FDA and regulated industry is quite a saga. At least it is in the medical device area. It seems that the user fee agreements negotiated by the pharmaceutical and biotech industries, even the generic industry, even over biosimilars, have sailed through to Congress relatively smoothly. But I believe that the device agreement, which is still being negotiated by FDA and industry, has been somewhat more contentious and certainly problematic in terms of the fact that although the other user fee agreements were delivered to Congress last week, we're still waiting for the medical device user fee agreement, MDUFA. Could you offer some insight, to the extent that you have it, on what's happening between industry and FDA behind closed doors? What are the sticking points that are making the negotiations over the device user fees so difficult?
I think there are several things that are impacting the complexity and the difficulty of the negotiations. One of the challenges that all stakeholders have in this current round of user fee reauthorization for devices is that we're in the midst of major changes being considered, particularly in the 510K system. So what the various stakeholders are trying to do is to anticipate what those final changes might look like and how that will affect the number of submissions, the complexity of submissions, or the types of data that is being submitted. And without having a lot of clarity there, everybody is, in one sense, shooting in the dark a bit. If 510Ks become twice as complex, well, that will affect the amount of effort by the agency that's needed. If you have twice as many or half as many submissions, that also affects the financial aspects. So that's a major difference, I think, between the device world right now and the other ones, particularly because we're now in our third round of user fees, and so people are expecting significant changes. And so there is currently, I think, a disagreement between all stakeholders on the question about how well FDA is doing. And without a consensus on how well the agency is doing in terms of meeting past objectives, timeliness, robustness of reviews, you have people coming in with different preconceived notions. The other obvious challenge here is just the amount of money and how much of the total cost industry should pay. And it's initially, obviously, a dollar and cent question, with the agency seeking substantial increases in user fees. And obviously, anytime you ask for more money, people push back. But it's particularly complex this year, because apart from user fees, we now have the device tax that will be starting in the near future, the 2.3% tax. So from industry's perspective, they are looking at a double whammy, so to speak, with a new user fee with significant increases being requested by the agency. At the same time, they're being asked to pick up a substantial new tax, several billion dollars a year, from the device tax as part of the Health Care Act passed by Congress. So you see this exacerbating the challenges from industry just looking at the pure financial impact of this. And then you have all the usual discussions or debates over where the money should be spent, how it should be spent, and then the philosophical challenge where user fees are based upon submissions. How much of user fees can or should be appropriately spent on other activities within CDRH, such as post-market surveillance, development of infrastructure, or other non-direct review costs. So I think all those things combine to make this an unusually complex and difficult discussion for all stakeholders.
So as I understand it, you're suggesting that the real challenge here for FDA and industry is they've both got substantive disagreements and financial disagreements. The substantive disagreements relate to what's called the 510K process, which I believe is for, is it class 2 medical devices?
Generally, yes.
And the challenge there is there's been some concern that some products, metallic hip implants, some problems with implantable cardiac defibrillators a couple of years ago, have raised the question of whether or not the FDA should be requiring significantly more data or pre-market testing of those products before they are allowed to go through that process, which pushes them all the way, or could potentially push them all the way up into the most rigorous PMA, I think it's called, pre-market approval category. So you've got industry and FDA debating at some level how well the 510K process has worked, when it hasn't worked, and what you might need to do to address those issues. That's an incredibly complex topic. And I imagine you have a lot of disagreement between industry and FDA over that. And then, of course, as you pointed out, if the FDA believes that there's going to be a more complex package for 510K products, it's going to be asking for higher user fees. And as you said, the industry is looking at that as a significant financial burden at the same time that they're looking at the medical device tax under the Affordable Care Act about to hit them.
That's all very accurate. Let me add one more level of complexity. There's the debate over whether the 510K system is robust enough from a safety perspective. And you've given a couple of examples, the hip implants and some implantable defibrillator. The ICD, which is sometimes incorrectly reported, is not a 510K product. That's under the PMA system.
Okay.
But it sometimes gets blended together vacantly. And then you have things such as the hip implant, which has a rather a unique regulatory pathway, given that it's what we refer to as a, quote, pre-amendment device. But at the same time, people are debating the safety aspects of this. And by the way, I think that FDA does a very good job in the safety assessments. You have industry and other stakeholders very concerned over what they perceive to be a slower, less predictable review process. And so you have some stakeholders saying you need to do more. You have other stakeholders saying you are restricting and slowing the delivery of beneficial new products to patients in need. Because of how the system is working. So you also have that fundamental philosophical challenge. And I'll add on top of that then the impact of the current economic challenges with the movement of manufacturing and R&D outside the U.S., in part, it's reported, in response to the perception of unpredictable or excessive regulatory burden.
I understand one survey, I believe it was from the California Healthcare Institute, correct me if I'm wrong, found that in Europe, I guess for their CE process, which is equivalent to the FDA's PMA process, products get to market from first communication to actual marketing 2 years faster than in the U.S. And for small startup medical device companies that may be burning through capital pretty quickly, given the requirements that there may be for clinical trials or other types of data, that's a pretty substantial problem.
Yeah, I mean, time for a startup company is one of the most critical business factors. You don't have unlimited funds, and you're burning through money, and historically, the U.S. has been the marketplace that has supported the development costs. And if that's not in place, then the business model that the startups have used for a number of years quite successfully for patients and for the company is no longer effective.
Just to step back for a little bit, so we've got a number of user fee agreements that have been completed. They've been sent to Congress. Do you have any sense of how the disagreement, ongoing negotiations, call it what you will, between CDRH and the medical device industry is going to affect or not affect the resolution of those other user fee agreements in Congress?
I'm not part of the user fee negotiations. That's being done in fairly private sessions, though there are public minutes. My prediction for what it may be worth, is that sooner or later, industry and FDA and other stakeholders will have to come to an agreement on user fees. I think that's the more probable outcome in the device world. But it's obviously lagging behind the others. I think that Congress will address the other ones, the drug user fee, the pharmaceutical user fees, or the biologics in their due time. and that the challenges being faced in the device world and the slower time frame should not, and probably there's no reason that they would have, a significant impact on the other user fee agreements.
And that's helpful. You mentioned a couple of minutes ago that there's this perception of, obviously, time is the lifeblood for these companies when they're trying to get to market, that Europe has perhaps a more predictable, transparent, and certainly faster or potentially faster process for bringing those products to market. What is Europe doing differently that companies are pointing to that provides that agreement? And is there anything that the FDA and industry can learn from in terms of improving the predictability in the U.S.?
The European system, the so-called CE system, has some fundamental differences from the U.S. system. The review process is actually outsourced from the government to private bodies, so-called notified bodies, who actually do the review. The other difference is that in many cases, particularly for products in the U.S. we would call 510K products, Europe views them more as tools for a physician to use as compared to the therapy itself. So what Europe is often looking for is adequate evidence that the product performs the function that the manufacturer is claiming for it, that the tool does, you know, what the manufacturer says. And they leave to the physician whether the outcome of that tool is good or bad as part of the practice of medicine. In the U.S. system, including the 510K system, the process is designed to provide a reasonable assurance of safety and effectiveness. When you get to effectiveness, that's more clinical outcomes, where you're looking more at it as a therapy as compared to a tool. So, for example, I may have a catheter, ablation catheter. Well, Europe tends to ask the question more, does the catheter do what it says it's supposed to do? Does it ablate the way it says it does? The U.S. asks some different questions, such as, is ablation an effective therapy? In Europe, that's more of a question for physicians. In the U.S., that's something the agency takes an interest in.
Do we have any differences between the U.S. and the EU in terms of post-market surveillance, percentage of products withdrawn from market because of severe safety issues, those kinds of comparative data?
There are some differences in post-market surveillance systems between the U.S. and EU. The EU vigilance system does not collect or require the submission of nearly the number of reports that you get with MDRs. You also don't have Europe-wide data that's readily available. Each country there has its own post-market data, its own post-market system. So it's much more difficult to get a broad European view. In the U.S., being one country, we have a much more robust one-country system rather than a fragmented system. Your question about comparative data is a very interesting question. It is very hard with the available data, public data, to do a very precise assessment. There was one consulting group that has looked at that using the best data they could find, and they could not find any meaningful difference between recall rates for high-risk recalls, which is what they looked at, between the EU and the U.S. FDA has questions and objections to their methodology. They do have a few examples where they believe that the EU allowed products on the market that had safety problems. When those products did not make it to the market in the U.S., industry asserts that those examples actually are not relevant. But there's not a lot of good data. What data does exist by these consultants has a conclusion that the rates of high-risk safety recalls is about the same.
You've painted a pretty, I think, nuanced picture of both the differences and the challenges facing regulators in the U.S. and the EU. Last question. The industry, I think, has portrayed itself as an industry in crisis from both a regulatory perspective, from an access to venture capital perspective, and then, of course, under pressure, as you pointed out earlier, from the medical device tax under the Affordable Care Act. Is this an industry that's going to see a significant or potentially significant offshoring of both investment and manufacturing capacity in the next several years as a result of these different pressures, whether or not you know they're correctly perceived or whether or not you think that the EU really has a better system?
I think not only that that will happen, I think it's already happening. I think you have seen substantial transfer of manufacturing in the medical device area from the U.S. outside the country. I think you also see a lot more research, particularly first-in-human research, being done outside the U.S. than was the case a few years ago. And at the end of the day, one of the critical values of the medical device industry is the intellectual capital, which is the researchers, the clinical data, and that is being developed more and more outside the U.S. than within the U.S. I was talking to a venture capitalist at a very large VC firm, and their view is that they essentially are no longer investing in companies in the U.S. That have a PMA need, that the regulatory uncertainties and complexities and time just make it an unwise investment. And there are a number of other VCs that have reported that they have gotten out of funding startup U.S. companies. Another VC reported that they now have opened offices in Europe and are doing much more funding of European, including Israeli, companies than was the case a few years ago. So in conclusion, I think you have seen and will continue to see, absent some change in the medtech ecosystem, manufacturing moving overseas, R&D moving overseas, reduced venture capital funding in the U.S., and easier access to venture funding for companies outside the U.S. as compared to the U.S.
Well, that's a pretty sobering portrait of the industry that used to be you know, one of the U.S.'s strengths in the life sciences field. We'll keep a close eye on it. And, Ralph, I hope you join us again soon.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.